I am Jewish, and bring an interesting mix of the Jewish, with Dick as a Catholic and a Quaker, we figure I've got the Jewish, he's got the Protestant and Catholic part, so we're a fairly ecumenical interfaith couple. I'm also on the board of the Jewish Peace Fellowship and used to be on the National Board of Amnesty International. We together very much enjoy things like canoeing. We are also parents and grandparents, and so have tried to combine a commitment to nonviolence and fundamental social change with also a commitment to family, and have worked very hard through the years to try to be faithful to both, which I think is one of the challenges of trying to live a nonviolent lifestyle, not only interpersonally, but societally and internationally. When you have conflicting pulls on you of jobs where you are earning money, family who wants your attention and needs your attention, and the broader society that is hurting because of injustice.
In terms of nonviolence specifically, kind of the experience that we bring to this, I was raised as a Quaker, and as you know, Quakerism is a pacifist denomination, so I heard about nonviolence almost from at my mother's breast. And was involved in many demonstrations as a Quaker from the very earliest days. We were involved in all the various movements in the 60s and 70s around Vietnam and so on. And I think my most profound experience with nonviolence was first volunteering and then becoming a member of the national staff of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. So I had a chance to get to know Martin Luther King rather well and to participate in a number of the campaigns that he started.
We also were part of a community in Philadelphia called the Philadelphia Life Center, which, and the broader political arm of that, if you will, was called the Movement for New Society. And that was really an attempt to have a training community. It's really our alternative to West Point, Annapolis, and the Air Force Academy, feeling very strongly that we've got to have places where people can be trained in nonviolence. Dick and I met doing civil rights work, so beside the Vietnam and peace movement and many of the other anti-interventionist movements in Central America, I mean, our very first date was going to see where the police should be positioned because we expected a riot after a black family moved into the area. So that has been part of our origins of meeting, a romantic beginning, and has continued through many, many years. It's really out of all of these experiences of over 30 years now of working for social justice out of a commitment to nonviolence that we want to be sharing tonight and then in the days to come.
Our contemporary interest in nonviolence is because the world faces these enormous problems of the potential of war and actual war breaking out in various parts of the world. The reality of dictatorships and totalitarian regimes of the left and the right, and how do you deal with those. The whole ecological crisis that we face, and all the other major problems that the world faces now. And how do you deal with these? How do you approach them? And we feel that nonviolence and nonviolent movement building and nonviolent struggle is one of the most effective ways, if not the most effective way, of responding to these major problems that we face. We feel it's not passive or weak, it's not just turning the other cheek as it's often described as being, but it's a very strong, assertive method of working for peace and justice. And if developed carefully and organized well, it can have a powerful transforming effect on these major problems. We also are very interested in nonviolence because it's in harmony with our faith, even though Phyllis is Jewish and I'm a Quaker Catholic. It's very much in harmony with our basic orientation toward prophetic biblical faith. What we want to do this evening is first to define what we mean by nonviolence, and that definition will kind of recur all the way through the three presentations that we'll make. Then we want to just tell some stories about nonviolence because I think in our experience it gets across better if you just say, well, here's how it actually happened in historical situations, rather than trying to do a scholarly one, two, three lecture kind of thing about nonviolence. And then we want to ask for a response from you. So if you'll be thinking as we're talking about either your own experiences in nonviolence, whether in a personal kind of situation or in a movement organizational kind of situation, and also any questions that might arise from what we say, because we'll try to leave time at the end. This first time, we'll have a little bit less discussion. The second one, we'll have more discussion, and the third one, it'll be all mixed up with everybody participating from the very, very beginning. So we want to start with the definition of nonviolence. Nonviolence is a way of behaving by an individual, a group, or even a nation that has three characteristics. One is it resists and refuses to cooperate with evil or injustice or wrongdoing. That's number one. It's a rejection, a resistance, a non-cooperation with what's perceived to be wrong. Secondly, while showing goodwill or love to any opponents that are found in the kind of struggle that comes out of that resistance. And third, being willing to take suffering on itself rather than inflicting suffering or violence on the other party that's found in that struggle. So it has those three characteristics. We could tell you a lot of personal stories from our own personal experience or the experience of others of how nonviolence is used in interpersonal kinds of situations. A lot of books have been written on it, Nonviolent Response to Rape, for example, which is very important in the women's movement, Nonviolent Conflict Resolution. All of these things are really important, but we wanted to, since our time is limited, to talk more about nonviolence in the struggle for peace and justice, these big macro problems that we talked about. There are thousands, again, of historical examples that could be given from before the time of Christ up to the present. Again, many, many books have been written on this. Gene Sharp at Harvard is probably the world's most famous scholar of nonviolence and has done a whole lot on this, pointing out 198 different methods of nonviolence that have been developed over the years. But we want to talk about some very recent illustrations and then also some in which Lutherans were heavily involved because of Holden being what it is. First, and these are just brief, current, very recent illustrations, the Philippines, 1986, the overthrow of the dictator Marcos through nonviolent people power. The most dramatic moment, and we're going to show you a little videotape or a section on this, was on Sunday, February 23rd, 1986, when Marcos had sent 1,000 troops, a big bunch of armored personnel carriers, and 8 tanks. And they were sent to attack a group of military men who had defected from Marcos and were in this area called Camp Crane in Manila. And what happened was that tens of thousands of unarmed Filipinos went and positioned themselves between these two armies and defended the army troops who had defected from Marcos. And it was probably the turning point in the whole Philippine revolution. What a lot of people don't realize was that in this Philippine revolution, a lot of training, a lot of nonviolence training went into that and was behind that event. So let's just look at what happened there. That, by the way, is from a very wonderful tape on nonviolence from Mary Knoll called Where There Is Hatred, and it gives a whole bunch of examples and kind of a philosophy of nonviolence that goes with it. You'll see in that little clip that those three elements of the definition of nonviolence that we talked about are there. There's very, very strong resistance. I mean, these are people putting themselves right in front of tanks and guns. They're refusing to cooperate with the Marcos dictatorship, but they're acting in a way that shows goodwill toward those that they were confronting, toward the soldiers, and they were certainly willing to take suffering on themselves rather than inflict it on their opponents there. It's been very interesting since 1986 to look at the outbreak, so to speak, of nonviolence in so many, many parts of the world, and perhaps most dramatically in Eastern Europe. Does everybody remember who Jean Kirkpatrick is the UN ambassador under President Reagan. And back in about 1982 or so, she wrote a very important article in which she made a distinction between authoritarian regimes and totalitarian regimes. And her argument was that both kinds of regimes are bad, both of them are dictatorships, but authoritarian regimes, the totalitarianism of the right, can be changed, it can be transformed, it can be overthrown. So that's not quite as bad as totalitarian regimes, which are the dictatorships of the left, the communist dictatorships, which by their nature cannot be overthrown, have never been overthrown. And at that point in history, she was just about right, although not quite right, that there had never been a communist regime that had been overthrown since 1917. And then here we are, 8 years later, Poland has been overthrown, East Germany has been overthrown, Romania, Czechoslovakia, Hungary, and so on, down the line, and all of them by basically nonviolent means. In Poland, for example, they said, this was a revolution that came about without breaking a pane of glass. Really an amazing statement of nonviolence, without breaking a pane of glass. And in East Germany, they said, we had to convince the regime that we didn't want to kill them, we just wanted them to leave their jobs. And East Germany is one that I'd like to focus on just for a minute because of the role of the Lutheran Church there. Back in the fall of 1989, which was just less than a year ago, there was a big movement that started in Leipzig. There were protests there of demonstrations in the street that started very small with about 70 people. And the police were very brutal with them and pushed them around and arrested them. People began coming together in the Nikolai Church, which is a Lutheran church, and they had a Monday evening prayer service, a prayer service for peace. And the pastor called for a nonviolent attitude in the protests which were going to be happening, and quoted a great deal from Martin Luther King. Apparently he had read a lot about Martin Luther King. And he asked the people not to carry weapons and not to resist arrest. By October, the services at the Nikolai Church had gone up to about 5,000 people, and after the services, there were regular marches going out from the church. And soon, over a period of time, they had grown up until there were 20,000 people coming together, jamming into that church, and then going out and marching. Well, the government was very alarmed by this, and they sent several thousand police and troops with orders to shoot, that they were not going to take this anymore. And the East German government at that time was the only Eastern European government that had supported China in what they did in Tiananmen Square. So it seemed like they were very serious that they were willing to have their own Tiananmen Square and just to massacre people. The meetings kept happening in the Nikolai Church. The pastor kept calling for nonviolence and a nonviolent approach, but not to be afraid to keep resisting. So the idea of the first criteria, the resistance, kept on there. And at the time that the troops and the police came with orders to shoot, 150,000 people went out and marched anyway. And the church distributed leaflets calling upon the people to avoid violence. The bishop, the Lutheran bishop, asked all the churches to open their doors so that the people prior to the march could come in and have meditation and contemplation and prayer services so that they would go out in the right spirit, but also so that when the wounded came in, the doors of the church would be open to bring in the wounded. But when the head of security for Leipzig heard that there were 150,000 people coming out marching nonviolently, he countermanded Erich Honecker's, the premier's, order, and ordered the police and the troops not to fire. And that was kind of the turning point in the East German movement to overthrow that government. And by November, there were 1 million people that were demonstrating in Berlin, and the situation had become totally unmanageable from the point of view of the East German government. And now we have what we've seen of the wall coming down, a new democratic government being put in place, and Germany being being reunited. Several weeks after this October revolution in Leipzig, some grateful Leipzig residents put up this big banner across the main street in Leipzig that just said, "Thank you, church." So all of you who are Lutherans can feel some thanks for what happened there.
Yep. Dick mentioned when he talked about growing up as a Quaker and hearing about nonviolence at his mother's breast. I mean, I grew up as a Jew, hearing nothing about nonviolence and hearing only the horror of Hitler and the horror of the silence of so many people. And one of the things in my own journey to a commitment not just to nonviolence as a tactic, but philosophically and theologically, part of what I needed to do was to reclaim the reality that there were nonviolent movements even in the time of Hitler that gave me faith in humanity and brought me along to believe in nonviolence as a fundamental way, as I said, to affect social change and to act out of my own being. And we wanted to share again something from the time of Nazism that shows about what can happen in nonviolence, and again, it involves the Lutheran Church, which is very pleasing to me being here now. I think many of you might remember that in June of 1940, Norway was overrun by the Nazis. One of the decisions that had to be made at that time was, do we give up and just go along with what Nazism stood for and their edicts, or do we find some way to resist, again, using the definition that Dick shared of nonviolence? The original intent when Germany invaded Norway was to turn it into a province of Norway and to disband the parliament, and this is what they did. They disbanded the parliament, they outlawed all but fascist political parties, and they installed a man named Quisling as the head of state. What did Quisling do? What he did was he abolished the Norwegian constitution and all elections. He told people that all government offices had to be filled from above. He put in the enforcement of the new order, or the herd, which was modeled along the German stormtroopers. And he said that all resistors were to be arrested, tortured, and shipped to concentration camps. And his immediate focus was on teachers, because teachers are the shapers of youth. And if you can get to the teachers, then you can get to the youth, and then you have it. What he did was he said then to the teachers that his photo had to be in all the schools, that the curriculum had to be revised in order to teach the virtues of fascism, that the teachers must give students sympathetic view of the fascist regime, that the students had to join the fascist youth movement, and that the teachers had to join the union, which was headed by the herd. How many of you here are teachers? There are a number of teachers, and I think if I were to ask how many of you see yourselves as teaching others, whether it be within families or congregations, etc., how many more would put up their hands? Yeah, I think we're all teachers in one way or another. And I think that, again, is a very moving thing to me as I continue to share a little bit of what we all hopefully would have done as teachers at that time. Basically, what Quisling said is, you teachers, do what I'm telling you to do, because I've got a gun at your head. And what did the Norwegian teachers do? They resisted. They absolutely resisted. They met secretly and came out with their own guidelines. And their guidelines were, don't obey government orders that conflict with conscience, the resistance. Don't teach Nazi propaganda, and don't join or cooperate with fascist organizations. There was again a response back. 12,000 out of the 14,000 Norwegian teachers, 12,000 out of 14,000, it's an incredible number, signed a declaration saying not to obey Quisling and not to join the union. Massive numbers of the students refused to join the student organization. So Quisling sympathizers held classes, those few Norwegian teachers that were following him, and the students refused to attend. Over 200,000 Norwegian parents and all of the Norwegian Lutheran bishops sent letters of protest to Quisling. So the government shut down the schools. What did the teachers do? They just held schools in people's homes. The Nazis and Quisling came back again and responded by arresting 1,300 teachers. They sent them to Gestapo-run concentration camps in the frigid north of Norway, put them on starvation rations, and began to torture them. 2 months later, the schools reopened, and Quisling thought everything was all right. But still, the teachers refused to join the union. And they read this statement that they wrote, and I think it's an incredible statement of courage, an incredible statement of nonviolence. And this is what they said. You can just imagine if you were one of the teachers with all of this going on. 1,300 of your colleagues were in concentration camps. You didn't know what was happening, going to happen to you or your family. And yet what they wrote was, "The teacher's vocation is not only to give children knowledge. Teachers must also teach their pupils to believe in and uphold truth and justice. Therefore, teachers cannot, without betraying their calling, teach anything that violates their conscience. That, I promise you, I shall not do." The Gestapo, after that statement, came in and said, "We're going to take your arrested colleagues and kill them." And again, I think one can do something to yourself. I can say, you know, I, Phyllis, will respond that way. But what happens if my actions influence other people? If I, as a teacher, stand strong and I have 1,300 colleagues that are going to be in trouble because of what I do, do I have that strength to continue to resist nonviolently? And yet the Norwegian teachers did. They refused to go along. And this is in my own imagination. I image this scene because it's such a powerful thing, particularly when I'm feeling tired. What happened was that the Gestapo put the 1,300 Norwegian teachers that were already in concentration camp on cattle cars to send them further north. And as the cattle cars rolled on through the towns in Norway, at all of the crossings, what the teachers in the cattle cars could hear through the walls of the cattle cars were their students singing to them. You know, and town after town, at all the crossings, there were the support in the voices of the students and their parents. And the teachers refused to back down. Their courage inspired the nation of Norway. And instead of intimidation, because of the witness of the Norwegian teachers, the strength of the Norwegian Lutheran Church, etc., there were labor strikes, clandestine newspapers and leaflets developed, there was the hiding of Norwegian Jews, half of the Norwegian Jews were saved, and the symbol of all this became the paper clip. People would often, as they walked down in the street, in their lapels or ties or whatever, would have a paper clip. And as you walk down the street, you could see people with the paper clips. And you know, from working as teachers or being in families, a lot of times people will string together paper clips, and it's you hang together. And so one of the symbols of the nonviolent resistance in Norway became the paper clip, and people saw that they were not alone, as those teachers, through their cattle cars, knew they were not alone. An historical example of nonviolence that's, I think, very relevant today.
When you think that Germany, which has been so deeply influenced by the Lutheran faith, was pretty much just going along with Hitler, and there was very, very little protest there as Hitler came to power and consolidated his power and began doing what he did. And most of the other European states were just going along, shipping the Jews off, helping Hitler to ship the Jews to the concentration camps and so on. This Norwegian example and a couple of other Scandinavian countries becomes, I think, kind of especially meaningful and almost unique during that period. And the role of the specific role of the Lutheran Church in Norway was very interesting at this time too. As many of you are Scandinavian background and know that the Norwegian Church is the Lutheran Church is the largest church in Norway, and at that time, I don't know if it still is, but it was the state church. From the very beginning of the Nazi invasion, the pastors started preaching sermons against the invasion, issuing pastoral letters against the invasion. Quisling tried to recruit the pastors into something that he called the Christian Unity Movement, of which he made himself the head. And only 20 of the 1,000 pastors in Norway joined that. And those 20 then found that their services were boycotted, so that when they went to church Sunday morning to preach, nobody was there. Quisling then appointed himself the head of the state church. And what the pastors did was they all resigned. So in effect, they disestablished themselves from the church and held services in their homes, since they then were not permitted to use the churches. And the bishops of the Lutheran Church made this statement, which is a comparable one to the teachers. To continue administrative cooperation with a state that uses force against the church would be to break faith with the Holy of Holies. As the time came for Luther, so it has come for us to follow our convictions and to uphold the righteousness of this church as opposed to the injustice of the state. God himself stands opposed to tyranny through the power of his word and his spirit. Woe to us if we here do not obey God rather than man. Really a great Lutheran statement. As a Catholic, I'm glad to say that the Roman Catholic bishop, whose name was Mangers, went along with this, and he was called into Gestapo headquarters and told to remove his signature, and he said, you can take my head, but not my signature. So I'm glad that while all the Catholic bishops of Germany were going along with Hitler, that Bishop Mangers stood up with the Lutherans. The one figure which kind of symbolizes all of this to me was Bishop Evid Berggrav. Is that a name which Lutherans hear about?
Yep.
Uh-huh. Well,
at least Norwegian.
Okay, good. Just remember again the definition of nonviolence, the resistance and non-cooperation to evil, the goodwill, and the willingness to take suffering on oneself. Bishop Berggrav preached consistently against Nazism, so the government forbade him to speak. He said, if you want to keep me from going to church, you will have to use force. And so he was imprisoned and then placed under house arrest. And he had 12 policemen who were assigned to him to guard him. And because of his very loving kind of approach, now these were fascist, you know, Nazi-trained police, but his approach and his convincing way was so powerful that over a period of time, they began to allow him to leave from house arrest. And he went out and he would meet with members of the Norwegian resistance and help to form statements of anti-Nazi statements and so on. And they even finally got him a police uniform so that he could go out in disguise from his house. And you can read about this. There's several books about Bishop Berggrav. But one of the most moving things to me was that when the Allies were about to win in 1945, the guards said, look, we're afraid that our bosses are going to do some kind of killing of the leaders as kind of the last revenge kind of thing. We're afraid they're going to come in here and kill you. We better allow you to escape so you can get away and hide. And he said, yes, but if you do that, you're going to be killed because certainly if you allow me to escape, you'll be held responsible for this. So he got in contact with the resistance and was able to get a bunch of British parachute cord, you know, from the British paratroopers who had been dropped behind the lines in occupied Norway. And he tied up his guards with this British parachute cord so it would give the impression that a British special British commando team had come in and had overpowered them and left them there. And only then was he willing to leave. So the love, the goodwill toward the opponent there was so beautifully expressed in him. The upshot of all this in occupied Norway was that Hitler, seeing from afar this incredible resistance of the Norwegian nation, ordered Quisling to give up his plans to establish this corporative state, as he called it, in Norway. And Quisling went to a big teachers' gathering in the town of Stabakk in Norway, and made a speech, and at the end of it he said, you teachers have ruined everything for me.
Hallelujah.
Yeah, praise the Lord. So to me the implications of this, even though Norway was not ultimately freed of Nazi occupation until the end of 1945 with the Allied victory over Hitler, it shows that the Nazi efforts to impose their will by military means in an occupied country that they completely controlled militarily could be defeated by nonviolent means. And it shows that nonviolence can withstand very, very severe repression and really battle a tyrannous kind of regime into a stalemate. And one can only wonder what would have happened if in other European countries that same kind of resistance had been taken to Hitler, whether we would have needed to go through the trauma of World War II that we did. We want to say just a little bit about philosophy of nonviolence too, and we'll be very brief here because I think it's come out in the examples. Yeah. Mm-hmm. We've got until quarter after. Is that right?
Seven. Do we have till seven?
No, till 7:15.
7:15.
Good.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, because we do want to get some reactions from you and some discussion. But since most of us here are coming from a Christian background, I want to make two points about the philosophy of nonviolence. One is that nonviolence was not something that was discovered, in quotes, by Christians. There were many examples of nonviolent resistance from before the time of Christ, and probably the most scholarly work that's been written on this is by Gene Sharp. It's called The Politics of Nonviolent Action, in which he gives probably 1,000 different examples, historical examples of nonviolence. And quite a number of them go back before the time of Christ. And of course, many non-Christians like Gandhi have used and developed nonviolence. The second point, though, is how well nonviolence fits in with the life and teachings of Jesus. Because if you think about it, Jesus didn't teach us how to destroy our enemies, which would be a military approach, but rather how to love our enemies. He didn't teach us how to make others suffer, which would be a military approach, but rather how to take up one's own cross of suffering. He didn't teach us how to persecute others, but he taught us how to pray for our persecutors. He didn't teach us how to kill, but rather how to die. He didn't teach us how to hate, but rather how to love. So nonviolence, to me, is so compatible, so in harmony with Jesus, and takes so much inspiration from Jesus.
I think we've spent a lot of time today looking at some of the history, and I know as a woman, one of the things that's happening and started to happen for women is the taking back of our own history, that we don't hear much about women in history. We hear much more about men, and I think the same kind of thing is happening now and needs to happen much more in terms of nonviolence. We study in school all the wars, but we don't study the examples like the Norwegian one, and I think part of the excitement and part of why we wanted to spend tonight looking at some of the historical is part of that reclaiming of history that many of us were denied through a lot of years. We talked in the very, very beginning about the serious problems, obviously, that the world is facing now. You know, war, dictatorship, poverty, ecological destruction. And we hope that what we've done in just laying it out now is to show that nonviolence is incredibly active. It is not passive, it is not weak, it is a strong method for fundamental social change. That it can have a powerful, transforming effect that works to better a lot of people's lives, not just people who are oppressed, but those whose lives are changed in the process of working for nonviolence. And that it really is a process that's in harmony with our faith, that can make us more whole people as we try to be faithful to what God calls us to be in terms of beloved community, in terms of shalom, etc. We wanted to use the last part of tonight just to see if there are any questions or concerns about what we've said or any of your own experiences with nonviolence that you might like to share. This is a time for dialoguing back and forth.
And please feel free to share any experiences you've had, I think, just to add to the richness of the history here.
Upshur, I was for 5 years part of a community in the Twin Cities area called the Community of St. Martin, which is organized around Christian belief in nonviolence and justice and reconciliation. And we were very opposed to U.S. policy in Central America. And both of the senators from Minnesota were supporting that U.S. policy of the Contras, supporting the Contras in Nicaragua. So we began a nonviolent action of each week going to our senators' offices and holding prayer vigils in the offices and then having dialogue with the staff members there, and continued that for 3 years, 4 years actually, in Senator Dernberger's office. And it was a really interesting, a lot of other creative things went on as well. We helped organize a blood drive in the office where we did a kind of a sneak attack, took over the office, got the Red Cross to come in and set up a blood drive in his office to donate blood to the victims of the Contras and his name, and quite a few other things. But what was really interesting about it was the amount of dialogue it did create between us and the staff members there. And when Senator Dernberger eventually did change his vote and became a leading opponent to the Contra cause there, and in conversations with other groups often cited the efforts of this weekly prayer vigil in his office, and then a commitment to dialogue following the prayer vigil is one of the things that have been influential for him in changing his mind. So it was a really also, we went at it not so much expecting to change his vote, but as a way for us to just witness to what we strongly believe and show our own dissent from his position.
I know that there's often a quote that's given about how we try nonviolence for one day and decide it doesn't work and go back to violence. My own experience has been with the Ground Zero community, working with Jim and Shelley Douglas. And of course, we didn't stop or continue to not stop the Triad Nuclear Submarine from coming into the Bangor base over across the water from Seattle. But I mean, some very powerful outcomes have happened, including the prosecuting attorney for Kitsap County, who was prosecuting one of the Civil Disobedience Acts that they'd done in Act of Resistance, became converted in the process of the court trial, and stopped his position and has come over and now works with the Ground Zero community leader. So it's always a difficult thing for me to think about the outcome and measuring, I guess, the effects. You know, if the ultimate goal is to get rid of the Trident, or how do you sort of measure the success? And other people who have done some teaching here have talked a lot about, like you shared, many, many stories that are just not recorded about successful events that were powerful in the businesses.
I think what both of you talk about is, and I think it's the power of the goodwill towards the opponent and the potential for conversion, whether it be the prosecutor or it be Dernberg, or we were part of an organization that was infiltrated by a paid FBI informer. And we learned that when somebody broke into the FBI offices outside Philadelphia, and here was one of our staff folks that we were working very closely with, who was the staff person also for the FBI. And one of the things that was pretty moving to us and also pretty amazing was that he asked to continue to work with us, because in the process of being an infiltrator, he had been converted by what he was reading and the way people related to each other. I think one of the other things that what you say reminds me of is somebody who, a man named Bob Smith, who has been very faithful in front of General Electric in Philadelphia year after year after year. One of the things that Bob said was that the only thing that we have any control over is the means we use. We hope for the end, but it is important that means and ends be consistent, because the only thing we have control over is those means.
Well, I'm going to share maybe not a success, but sort of a greater sense of failure in in sort of recent U.S. incursions into various countries that I feel like we have, as a church and as a nation, have failed to speak out against effectively enough. Senator Kennedy spoke out against the Panama invasion, but it was very late after the fact. We let that go on, and I was just listening to NPR now tonight, and they're estimating that within 2 weeks there will be 200,000 American troops in Saudi Arabia. They're arriving. John Itzi was their correspondent. They're arriving all night long. He says, you know, a gunship arrives every minute, and emptying all these troops. I'm just thinking that I guess the success I think that nonviolence has had is that we maybe managed to prevent a U.S. invasion of Nicaragua through the Pledge of Resistance. I mean, I think. So with so many signatures on that pledge, there was a sense that if the U.S. should attempt to invade Nicaragua, we, the American people, hundreds of thousands of people, would organize mass protests, and so it didn't happen. But the failure is that in that same time, we invaded Grenada, we invaded Panama, and it looks like we're going to be having a war in the Middle East, and I wonder how we managed to let this happen, that we haven't organized a pledge of resistance to foresee this, or how, before our very eyes, our country continues to invade people. So I guess I feel success over Nicaragua and the pledge of resistance there. And I think I know you're on the national board, and you know, you're witness for peace. But anyway, pledge of resistance also. Anyway, it's been fabulous what you've done there. But then, meanwhile, we just take over other countries.
Yeah. I think that's something important to keep in mind, not to think of nonviolence as a panacea. You know, it has a mixed record of success and failures, just like violence does.
But this was our failure to not organize against these other things. I mean, I'm just saying it as sort of a confession, not that the method failed. I think it worked where we used it on the Nicaragua situation. We didn't on these others.
I just have a question in terms of your perceptions culturally as to where we're at, specifically, I guess, the United States. My sense is that when I talk with people and the concept of nonviolence comes up, that I find that they're very, it's either very skeptical or it's viewed kind of with disdain, that no, we need violence, and that really seems to me to be the predominant force or view or philosophy of people that it's needed. Having a much broader picture than I do living in Everett here, what is your sense of that in terms of, is it growing? Is there a nonviolent movement? I didn't catch the beginning because I got second dinner, but I'd be interested in your perceptions of it.
I think it's like a lot of other things that begins very small and then sort of slowly grows and has its setbacks, and then it goes forward a little bit and has more setbacks and goes forward a little bit. But the trajectory, I think, is toward a broader acceptance and a broader understanding of it. And one example of this to me is in the Catholic bishop's statement on peace, the peace pastoral, that most of it was a justification of the traditional Catholic position of just war. But they had a whole large section in there about nonviolence, and very, very strong statements on nonviolence. And that, to me, I think if that position had been, or that pastoral had been written 10 or 15 years ago, there would have been no mention of nonviolence at all in it. But it's become enough accepted that they had to give attention to it. And there were bishops within the committee that were advocating that also. That's just one example, I think. And also, what's happened in Eastern Europe has made people aware. Somebody was getting into a taxi cab in New York, and just when the Berlin Wall was coming down, and the taxi cab driver said, you know, there's something really strange going on. The people without guns are winning, you know? And that, I think that's the perception, that some people are realizing that there is a power here. When you see a regime that, you know, like in East Germany, I mean, they had all the military, they had all the police, you know, they could have machine gun people like they did in Tiananmen Square, and yet the people without the guns were able to overthrow that government. So there is a power here that I think people are recognizing.
But I think, if I might, I think it has to be named. And I don't think, I haven't heard people talking so much about, it's been nonviolent movement in Eastern Europe that caused that to happen. It's been looking on in amazement, but without claiming it as nonviolence. Even in the overthrow of the Shah in Iran and when the Ayatollah came in. I mean, if you look at that, that was basically done by nonviolence. I might not like either of them in terms of outcome, but that was nonviolence. But we're not using the word. And I think that disempowers people who want to affect change. And I think in terms of the Middle East, which is such a complicated area, more, infinitely more so than Central America, part of what we need to be doing is to say, yeah, we've got now, you know, all these troops there, but it's not yet too late. And how can we learn from the historical, how can we learn from the present reality of what happened in Eastern Europe? How can we as a community in the United States pull together pretty quickly? Because in the U.S., at least in the Middle East, as I understand it, you've had the Jewish groups looking at the Middle East. You've had some Palestinian and Christian pro-Palestinian people. There hasn't been a whole lot of talking back and forth. So I think we're further behind in terms of that kind of dialogue to respond quickly to what's happening now. But the gunning hasn't started and hopefully won't. So there is time. And even if a shooting war starts, I think that still says to me, at least, we've got to find nonviolent alternatives to get us all out in the streets to protest, so it's going to cost too much over there to want to continue it. It's not wanting to give in to the frustration and fear, although I also hear what you're saying, Barb, and feel some of that myself.
You actually just addressed what I was about to ask you, but with 200,000 troops there with guns that haven't been used yet, I mean, what are some of the things in terms of mobilizing? I'm feeling sort of at a loss for knowing how to go about what needs to happen in making a reactive voice.
Anybody have any ideas?
Well, it was interesting tonight when they started reading off the list of who was there, and it was the National Guard from Detroit, Michigan, troops from Fort Rick. I mean, it was such an interesting mix of people from all over the United States. I think we need to get ourselves out of Golden Village and down to those National Guard armories and start protesting. I mean, because every state has a group there probably by now. I don't know if this will touch up here, but each state has places that you can go to protest.
One of Gene Sharp's theories, I keep mentioning him, is that war is functional in human society, that people resort to war when other alternatives that they've tried, negotiation, conciliation, mediation, things like this, haven't achieved their goals, and therefore they turn to a military response. And therefore he feels that one of the challenges of nonviolence is not just to protest against the military when you see the military, but to offer an alternative. And I think that's one of the big challenges for us in thinking about something like the Middle East. Another thing he says is you can't just come in with a prescription as though nonviolence was something you should pull out of the air and apply, you know, just kind of dump into situations. You have to understand the particular historical situation, like the military going into Saudi Arabia now. They've got, volumes this thick of studies of the strengths and weaknesses of the Iraqi army, the territory, the geography, the social and political stuff. So they're moving in with an awareness of what they're dealing with. And the nonviolent movement, to come up with an alternative, I think they don't need all those studies, but they need to have some understanding of what a nonviolent alternative would be. I think it's good to protest, but also the more you can present, but here would be a better way to do it, the more success you're going to have.
And I think part of the forum tonight, when we were talking about as faculty, and we mentioned the Middle East, part of having tonight's looking at what is the geopolitical and environmental reality in the Middle East is to begin that education, because I think for many of us, we are ignorant. And of the movements that I've seen in the Middle East, it really has been Palestinian movements and Israeli movements, and it hasn't much included the rest of the Middle East. And I don't think we have the analysis that Dick's mentioning that we are going to need to have, particularly in that area that is so complicated and also so sensitive in terms of politics, but also so sensitive in terms of Christian-Jewish relationships and Christian-Jewish and Palestinian or Muslim relationships. So it is more complicated and therefore more challenging to us, and we need to do a lot of quick study as well as kind of walk the talk, you know, and just get out there with our feet to also put into effect what we are talking about.
We just have one more minute. We've been encouraged to close right on time, so there's up
just
there
one other instance of nonviolence protest. An individual in Albuquerque decided to protest outside the gates of Sandia Laboratories, which are mainly tied up with the weapons industry. And even now, he simply went out there every morning and sat alone with a placard, I don't know what his placard said, at the gates to the Air Force base where the Sandia Laboratories are. And so all, everybody driving to work could see him there for an hour and a couple of hours every morning with his placard. And after 2 years, a headline came out in the newspaper that one of the scientists, one of the top scientists, had resigned. And this physicist gave us his reason for resigning was just driving past this one individual every morning.
Thank you.
And another piece of trivia, if you like, the name Quisling gave a word, in, certainly in Britain. I don't know whether it has in the United States, but the name Quisling is in the British dictionaries as meaning traitor.
That's where it came, was from Mr. Quisling.
Tomorrow, the kind of question that you raised about does nonviolence take too long? What are some of the other arguments against nonviolence is what we'll be talking about. You know, what are some of those myths? What are some of the realities that are often thrown up? So we would invite those who want to come back tomorrow to do so. I think in terms of pure emotion, and the kind of thing, Barbara, you were talking about in that sense, oh my gosh, what am I going to do? You know, I'm up in Holden Village, there are 200,000 people in Saudi Arabia. When I'm feeling that, I really often do pull out a paper clip that all of us use, and it throws me back to what I'm sure was that time in 1940 in Norway, and it helps recenter me and recenter some of the panic I might feel, to say there is historical base if we find ways to hold together, to hang together, like that circle of paper clips that can't be pulled apart very easily. You know, we will find some way to be able to make a dent into the horror of what we are seeing building up there. So I think it's, you know, through prayer, through paper clips, through being together in community, as well as becoming knowledgeable, and as well as it means becoming trained in nonviolence, that we're liable to have an impact, whether it be in Panama after the fact, what do we learn in the Middle East now, or in our own communities.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you.